Struggling to keep track of your story and world? Archivos is for you. More intuitive than a wiki, more extensible than Scrivener, Archivos builds your story Bible into your personal, always-on tactical display. Graphical relationship charting, continuity tools, this thing has it all, with bonus options for fan engagement and real-time collaboration. Archivos. Story world management done right. www.archivos.digital. That's www.archivos.digital. Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life. Welcome to episode 2 in our series on dialogue, in which hopefully I will not be giving a monologue. We'll find out. Last time we talked about character objectives and how they create the circumstances under which dialogue can happen and how they drive the dialogue through the scene, and they set up the conflicts in the scene. I should point out something David Mamet says that I didn't mention in the last episode, was that at bottom, plot and character are illusions that are created by the progression of conversation. The plot and the characters are driven by the frustrated and contrapuntal objectives of the interlocutors in a conversation. Now, he writes mostly for the stage and sometimes for the screen. He very rarely writes books. And so you can see how, especially on a stage when all you've got is dialogue, that's really, really true. But in a book, if you envision the narrator as someone who's basically supplementing the context for the dialogue, that rule translates very well, especially if your narrator is a character, such as would happen if you're writing in the first person, in which case everything in the book is dialogue, even the narration, or the narrator is a character of their own, a historian, a journaler, or just a disembodied voice that has an opinion about things.
Good examples of that would be the narrator in any of Douglas Adams' works.
Oh, God, yes.
And also Terry Pratchett's work. Mm-hmm. I think has that personality narrator.
But a good narrator, a really good narrator, always has an opinion about what's going on, even if they don't state it. And by keeping that in mind, you can turn your narration into another form of dialogue, which is actually really good for practicing the art of dialogue as well. Now, last time I brought David Mamet in as a good example, and Joss Whedon and Aaron Sorkin in as kind of bad examples of how to do dialogue, which is not to say that Sorkin and Whedon don't have their shining moments. They do, and when they do, they're amazing. But their baseline is pretty anemic. So today we're going to be talking about two writers who are at the opposite, who almost invariably, even in their bad films, write very good dialogue. And those are Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino. And we're bringing them in because they both exemplify what writers refer to as voice. Their characters have distinct, palpable voices. Now, you can always tell that it's a Kevin Smith dialogue or it's a Tarantino dialogue by the kinds of things that they prioritize and the kinds of characters that they write. However,
and the kind of swearing,
and the kind of swearing that they do, which is a really important part of dialogue, which we'll get to in the next episode on profanity.
Oof.
However, Tarantino and Kevin Smith are good writers to look at side by side because Kevin Smith writes entirely within one subculture, and Tarantino writes across a variety of cultures, although his characters do share some common threads throughout all his films. Both of them write incredibly stylized dialogue that winds up feeling completely natural, which is something that sets them apart from Sorkin and Whedon. Sorkin and Whedon write stylized dialogue that does not feel naturalistic, unless and except you're from the very narrow window of people they're trying to service in terms of, especially Sorkin, if you're in that wonkish class, it does feel kind of natural. But outside of that, it doesn't. Tarantino and Smith, whether you're from their subcultures or not, their dialogue feels so natural that it's terrifying. It almost looks invisible. Kevin Smith writes from inside a Gen X suburban New Jersey frame of reference. It's very specific. His characters are given to long discursions about apparently meaningless things. They fight over exposition points, and they speak as if they're just rattling stuff off up from the top of their head. But if you look at the script, and another couple writers we should talk about are Joel and Ethan Coen, because they also do this. If you look in the script, you'll notice that there's basically no improvisation. And the same is true with Tarantino. These are people who write screenplays that look improvised in terms of the dialogue. But almost not a word is improvised. In fact, in the Coens, in the case of the Coens, not a word is ever improvised. Tarantino and Smith, as directors, allow a certain amount of improvisation from actors they trust. What is it they do that makes that work? They inhabit as writers, they fully inhabit the world of the character. Now, Samuel L. Jackson is always Samuel L. Jackson. Always talks like motherfucking Samuel Jackson. He tones it back, for example, in the Star Wars films. But he's still Samuel Jackson. And George Lucas...
I think Mace Windu could have been improved by a few motherfuckers.
Yep. You're under arrest for treason, Chancellor. No. You're under arrest, motherfucker! No. Would have been so much better. But look at the difference, for example, in Tarantino films between Sam Jackson in Pulp Fiction and Sam Jackson in The Hateful Eight. Mm. And doing, and not to mention Sam Jackson in Django. Oh my God. Same actor, adding many of the same dialogue flourishes that Sam Jackson likes to do. But each character, completely different background, completely different set of concerns, completely different worldview, and that those worldviews and concerns leak through in every single syllable uttered. The syllables they utter build the world. The world is, yeah, it's created by the setting and the cinematography and the editing, but it's really created by the words the characters are speaking. There's so little exposition in a Tarantino film, and yet every syllable is exposition. And this is something Tarantino shares in common with Kevin Smith. Every syllable is exposition, and yet every syllable is a point of conflict. There aren't wasted words in these screenplays. There's nothing that goes on the screen that the screen could have done better without. The story needs every one of these. And each character, in a very limited sense with Kevin Smith, and an incredibly broad sense with Tarantino, each character has a different voice. And voice is one of the things that makes your dialogue sparkle and shine. To develop voice, you need a few different things in your toolkit. First, you need an ear. The human voice is a musical instrument. It is not primarily something we use to communicate ideas. That's an artifact of debate team thinking in school. Human language is not about communication. Human language is about persuasion and manipulation, as David Mamet pointed out. And whether in Pulp Fiction, whether it's Jules and who is John Travolta's character?
God, I forget the names.
Whether it's those two arguing about the metric system in and how it affects the way McDonald's hamburgers are named in France versus America at the opening of Pulp Fiction, or whether it's the story about torturing and raping and killing the son of the general in The Hateful Eight. These words paint an entire world, an entire character in moments. And they do it by the word choice, the accent, the concerns, the things the character decides to focus on, and the way that their background and their nature infests the way they speak. If you listen to different people around you, this is one of the reasons that in my upcoming Autodidact Bible book, and probably in next time I do a writer's book, if I talk about characterization, I've got a deep characterization book I'm working on based on the series we did here. I'm going to talk about how this works some, but it's super important for writers, especially any autodidact, but writers especially, to socialize vertically as well as horizontally. Vertical socialization means moving up and down the class chain in your society. And horizontally means socializing with people at your point in the class chain across, hopefully across a variety of societies. If you don't learn how people talk, if you don't listen when people talk to you, if you're primarily interested in getting your point across and you're a writer, you're missing the best education you can ever get. Because the way people talk and the things it reveals about them is written all over every interaction you have. And if you are in your own social and class bubble, you're not going to hear it because you know the language. But everybody speaks in code. There are the words we use, and then there is the silence between the words, which carries implication, it carries the interpersonal manipulative leveraging, it carries so much more weight than the words themselves. And the great trick of voice is using word choice and dialect and timing to play the silences between the words.
When you talk about vertical or horizontal socialization across different societies, mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
When I met you in college, I was engaging in a horizontal socialization. I was a middle-class kid from an academic background. It was also vertical socialization because I was a poor kid going to a wealthy school. But I was a middle-class kid from an academic background going to a school that catered to middle-class kids from a certain religious background in an academic setting. And I shared most of that religious background, though not all of it. That's horizontal socialization. You're going where the people you know are. Now, it was crossing a cultural line because I was moving from the cosmopolitan San Francisco to rural, at the time, rural or suburban Oregon, and the crowd that the school drew in was largely a non-urban, non-cosmopolitan crowd. So I was moving out of my accustomed bubble, but I was moving out of my accustomed bubble along an axis where I shared most things, and I wasn't moving all that far. So that's an example of horizontal socialization. So the some of the dialect was different, some of the code words were different, but the general code, that the unspoken rules of interaction, all that, were virtually the same.
Yeah.
I was just different enough that I could break them and look like I was extra fun, but mm-hmm. not different enough that I break them and get thrown out.
Mm.
Especially break them inadvertently and get thrown out.
Right.
I tried desperately to break them on purpose and get thrown out because I hated going to that school, but that's a whole other topic.
So horizontal would be same class, different cities.
Right. Or same class, different social groups. Whereas vertical is moving up and down the social hierarchies. It's hard to notice in a world that is so aggressively interconnected. But we actually, as a rule, we Americans, we Westerners, or we weird country people, who are of such a class that we're interested in writing and reading and leisure pursuits as a primary thing in the professional world, we have such a paucity of social stimulation that it's frightening. The historical norm required aggressive socialization up and down the hierarchy. Everyone knew how a nobleman or a businessman or a trader or a farmer or a peasant or a beggar or a leper or a priest spoke, thought, worked mentally.
At least within the points at which you interact with them.
Right. But up until the 17th century, the nobles, the servants, the serfs often slept in the same room with each other because there was no such thing as glass windows except in churches. And so you had to do it to survive and keep warm in the winter. People knew each other. And they had different mannerisms, manners, and expectations as accord to class, but they knew the other classes. They knew their code. The word condescend used to describe a virtue, which was the ability and willingness of those from a higher social tier to engage their social inferiors on the level with the inferiors in a way that did not emphasize their own superiority. Condescension changed in the Victorian era when everyone was socially climbing, and it became a way to signal your superiority by going in and slumming it with the lower classes, but not shedding the verbal and manneristic accoutrement of your higher class. So you would talk to a commoner or a whore in their own language, but you'd always make it clear that you were the one on top and you were giving them a great honor by associating with them. And that's where condescension got the bad name that it has today. And it's why we in America hate condescension, because we hate admitting that there's such a thing as social class. But there is, and it bleeds through everything. One of the most humiliating pieces of feedback I got as a young writer was when one of my first readers told me, "All of your characters talk like college-educated suburbanites." That was really humiliating, because I have not only associated or socialized with college-educated suburbanites, I come from blue-collar stock. I'm one generation off the farm on both sides. And my extended family on both sides are all tradesmen. I love the blue-collar world, always have, but I didn't come from it. I just grew up near it. But I was absolutely blind because I hadn't learned to listen to the differences in the music. And I didn't actually socialize with my extended family that much. I just identified with them. And there's a big difference, especially when it comes to writing convincing characters and dialogue. Every social class, every profession in the different social classes have their own jargon. They have their own code. And by code, I mean words that mean other things. They've got different connotations. And they've got their own expected manners. One of the things that has been causing so much conflict, one of many things, but one of the little things that's been causing so much conflict in the last 10 years in the West is that Gen X and the older millennials all went to college and were socialized in college into a very narrow normative niche in terms of expectations of language and etiquette and other things like that. And they brought those very narrow parochial expectations into workplaces, political contexts, church contexts, other social contexts where they are not appropriate. And instead of learning that when in Rome you do as the Romans do, they have behaved like imperialists and attempted to bully the cultures that they have freely associated with into conforming to their own culture of origin. And they've been terrifyingly successful at it. One of the results of that is the great cheapening and impoverishment of the arts, because when you don't have access to a variety of human expression and experience and social codes and other things like that, your ability to create characters, stories, etc., that inspire and transport your audience shrinks almost to zero. People come to fiction to live a different life virtually. They want to be stimulated, sometimes discomforted, but always stimulated by the exotic, that which they don't come in contact with every day. And it's no longer enough simply to do that with strange technologies that they're not used to, or strange procedures and technical things like how to run a logistics firm, or how a detective goes through the machinations of the procedure to solve a case. It's no longer enough just to get those things right, because everybody's seen it all. What you can't get through simple fantasy or research is access to the different worldview, the different way of thinking, and the way that that spins up through the way that people speak, and the way that people do the dominance dance with each other using their words, their silences, and their facial expressions. Vertical socialization is incredibly important to understanding class, culture, and human dynamics. And if you are not socializing up and especially down the social ladder, because in the weird countries, the upper classes try to look cool by emulating the lower classes. So going up the social ladder, except in some very rarefied contexts and narrow subcultures, doesn't actually get you much different than what you get from a middle class perspective. Socializing down the social ladder, that's where the cultural richness is, because they haven't managed to kill that yet by sticking everyone into the same education programs. And you'll always find richer cultures among people who have to play with their hands, among people who take large risks, people who have to take large risks, people who engage in creativity, and people who live at the fringes of society, because they don't get to depend on the accepted norms that people who are comfortable take for granted as forming the safe barriers around their world.
Can you bring this back to Quentin Tarantino?
So Quentin Tarantino does this really, really well. Really, really well. Take Pulp Fiction. In Pulp Fiction, you have a bunch of characters. Now, they're all working class, and they're all criminals, in one sense or another. But they have different aspirations. Even the Wallaces, Marcellus and his wife, I can't remember, Uma Thurman's character, I can't remember her name right now. The characters played by Ving Rhames and Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction. They're upper class financially, but they're still working class folks. They're working class folks with a big budget is what they are, and a lot of power. But in that working class criminal window that he presents, you've got the boxer, the stereotypical palooka, who's been asked to take a dive. He's got a New York attitude about things. You've got the rednecks who run the shop where Marcellus and Butch, the palooka, get captured and tortured. Oh boy, what a scene that is. You've got Butch's girlfriend or wife, the French girl, who is desperate to have a baby and settle down and have the happily ever after. You've got Uma Thurman's character, Marcellus's wife, who's trying to amuse herself and have fun even though she's really bored as a kept woman. She had a career that she was really proud of, but it didn't go anywhere, and so she's sort of treading water in her mid-20s. You've got the drug dealer's house run by Eric Stoltz and populated by white trash characters who are into kink and body piercing and other stuff that is a little self-destructive, including all the drugs. But they're fully realized characters with very authentic ideas about how things should be and what they want. And you get to see all these characters, you get to see all of them in the pinch. You get to see, in the case of Butch, you get to see quite a lot of backstory. In the case of others, you don't get to see backstory, but you still get the backstory. You've got the robbers who rob the...
Yes.
Who rob the restaurant. And, of course, you've got the two hitmen who go on divergent paths and journeys. through having slightly different ideas about what their job is for. One of them just likes being the muscle. And the other one likes the power that comes with it and starts to think that maybe the power would be put to better use in other ways. So you have, you know, they start off as similar characters, but one is totally status-driven and the other is self-actualization-driven, and that pushes them in different directions. It's a complete world. You don't have to have ever been in that world to really get it. And all of the characters speak differently, despite the fact that they all swear a lot and they all have a lot of clever quips. Their speech comes from not just the general culture they're in, but from the particulars of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes the dialogue thoroughly memorable and truly immortal. And you see that through all of Tarantino's films, including Jackie Brown, which I tend to think is his weakest. But the thing that Tarantino and Smith understand, they understand that human speech is not about conveying information, it's about persuasion. And they understand that the human voice is not a communications medium, it's an instrument, and that the words that come out are music. And so they structure their dialogue in a poetic fashion, and they tie it directly always to character motivations. They do not waste words. So they can get away with long speeches and soliloquies, and it feels completely natural. Even in a film like Clerks, which is two clerks hanging around wasting time because they don't want to have to be here today, the kinds of stuff that they're talking about is tied directly to the way they see the world, the things they want out of life, and how they're trying to negotiate this very crazy day in the life of a convenience store and video store clerk.
And that dialogue actually does sound like almost everybody I knew in when they were in their late teens and 20s.
A total suburban Gen Xer dialogue.
We had monologues like that about TV shows and comic books and
ethical conversations about whether the construction workers on the Death Star were unjustly slaughtered and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. But they're the kind of conversations you have in your 20s.
Mm-hmm. In real life, they tend to wander around a lot more than they do in the film. But like in real life, those conversations in the film are not ever about just what the characters are talking about. In that film, every conversation between Dante and Randall is Randall trying to push Dante to wake up and take responsibility for his life, and Randall trying to push Dante to wake up and take responsibility for his life instead of griping, and Dante trying to push Randall to stop rocking the boat so that everything can be tolerable. And he can make the boss happy, and he can reduce to the maximum extent the difficulties he's facing. And that essential conflict drives every single conversation, including the conversation about the Death Star.
And that also is what being in your 20s is like. Those are the kind of conversations you have with your friends in your 20s.
So,
and sometimes in your 40s.
Which is, which is the other thing that that unites Tarantino and Smith with Mamet and takes them away from the territory of Sorkin and Whedon, is that Tarantino, Smith, and Mamet always understand the dominance games at the heart of every conversation. And with Whedon and Sorkin, dominance games only come up when they're a plot point. They're not the baseline from which the character dialogue emerges. And that's one of the reasons that they tend to be weak, because dominance games are at the heart of every human interaction. It's not that everything in life is about power and subjugation. It's that we navigate through the world by finding our place in the pecking order through minor conflict with the people around us, and we are constantly renegotiating that all the time. And that's true even when you're in the military, even when you're working in the West Wing, even when you're in a formal environment where you know your official rank. If you've ever run a business or been in management, you know the org chart, which is the official rank of everybody, is never the same as the actual dominance hierarchy in the organization. The dominance hierarchy is worked out in real time on a day-to-day basis and has a lot more to do with who is effective at networking and connecting with who else, banking favors of currying goodwill, than it is about who has the official power in an organization. And Sorkin and Whedon very much don't understand that. Their org charts line up with their social dynamics in a very formal way. And that's one of the things that differentiates someone who's writing from inside a bubble. When you're inside a bubble long enough, you internalize the dominance hierarchy to such an extent that you reconcile it via a set of invisible rules with the org chart. And you begin, well, by the time you're an adult, you frequently just don't see the difference between the org chart and the dominance hierarchy. But anyone outside your subculture doesn't understand that. They don't understand those internalized norms that you carry around with you every day. And so if you're just writing inside your own subculture, or you're just projecting the norms and from your own subculture onto other subcultures because you like the tech that these people deal with, or you like the idea that in this strange world people can solve conflicts with duels, or they have cool magic at their disposal, you're not actually taking seriously what it is that goes into building those norms that you've internalized. And so you just come off with cosplay and not with verisimilitude. Verisimilitude is the convincing construction of an illusion, so much so that it feels absolutely real. And if your dialogue does not reflect the layers of the society, the subculture, and the situation in which it's emerging, you don't have verisimilitude. You might have fun, but you don't have great dialogue.
Okay.
Next time we'll talk about profanity and accents. And I think that'll probably wrap up our dialogues here.
All right.
Until then, we'll see you.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.